Hello, this is episode number 24 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, August 9th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. Last week, Congress passed the so-called Protect America Act, which revised the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and significantly broadened the Bush administration's powers to conduct warrantless surveillance. Members of Congress had only days to read the legislation, which was introduced just before the August recess. This week, we've got two special guests who charge that the legislation has undermined civil liberties. Julian Sanchez is a contributing editor to Reason Magazine, and Derek Slater is an activism coordinator of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And as always, I'm joined by Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Julian, let's start with you. The Bush administration says this legislation is needed to keep Americans safe from the threat of terrorism. Now, that sounds like a worthwhile goal, so what's so wrong with what they're proposing?
You know, I think in part what's wrong with what they're proposing is that it's so unclear exactly what that is. I mean, it seems like this is another case where the Bush administration has displayed its ability, like a good chess player, to force the hand of Congress with a sort of series of perpetual checks. And so, though there was a rather narrower and more clear-cut Democratic bill that Democratic legislatures say they believed DNI McConnell had agreed to or had been willing to accept, he now denies this. The following day at the 11th hour, it was announced that in fact he could not accept this. After all, the White House announced that it would veto this if it passed, and so they sort of very abruptly had to move with different legislation than they thought had been what they were working on. And the legislation that they had initially sort of hammered out would have narrowly fixed the supposed problem created by a secret FISA court ruling earlier in the spring, which is that it raised questions about whether strictly foreign-to-foreign communications routed through the U.S., and traditionally strictly foreign-to-foreign communications aren't covered by American privacy laws or constitutional protections, don't require court approval or oversight. And so there the question was whether it had to be made clear that just because one of these communications happened to be routed through a telecom hub in the United States, that it was nevertheless not suddenly counting as domestic surveillance. And the original bill would have closed that gap. And everyone who defends the new bill seems to go on and on at great length about how important it was to close that gap, which nobody disputes, and which all the bills under consideration would have done.
Can I just jump in here for a sec on what was at stake in the congressional debate? It's not as clear cut as the administration bill being really, really bad, and the Democratic compromise being a good compromise. It was a sham compromise, nevertheless.
Yeah,
there were many problems with that bill as well. And the bottom line is here is that Congress still has basically no details on what the president has been doing with this illegal spying program for the last nearly 6 years. And until that truth is unearthed, then it doesn't make any sense for Congress to be expanding spying powers. The fact is that FISA has been modified many, many times since it was first enacted to keep pace with technology, and the administration really offered hardly any evidence that it needed to be changed at all. So the fact that Congress was considering any action, even that sham Democratic compromise, was really disastrous to begin with.
I didn't mean to give an unqualified endorsement of the Democratic bill, but only to suggest that the focus of the rhetoric is bizarrely misdirected onto something that all bills had in common. And so it's strange to see that again and again we hear about the importance of closing this gap, but that this at least provides no distinction between the original bill and this even broader one, which finally passed, which leads me to think that there's an attempt to, again, draw attention away from the kinds of surveillance that the DNI and the White House actually apparently believe it's quite urgent to endorse or to authorize without judicial oversight.
The fundamental problem that I see with this legislation is that it abandons the principle that some, you know, impartial judge needs to look at each search or each eavesdropping before it occurs. It sets up this alternative procedure where basically the CIA or FBI or whoever just has to write up essentially a little report that's turned into a court after the fact that says, here's generally how our surveillance program works. And the judge simply looks at the general description, checks to make sure it's not, you know, egregiously unreasonable, and then basically rubber stamps the entire program. And no judge ever looks at a list of the specific people whose emails or phone calls are being spied upon. And that's a big change. I don't think, I mean, there have been very limited circumstances in which, you know, the executive branch has had that power. But as far as I know, this is the first time that you've had this sort of blanket ability to just declare somebody relevant to some foreign person, and then you basically get to eavesdrop on them without any sort of judicial oversight.
My guess is that the goal here is to, and the reason indeed that they press so hard for this kind of after the fact guideline approval as opposed to you know, having the court review applications in advance, is that there's an enormous amount of evidence that at least suggests that some kind of massive vacuum cleaner style filtering is going on, reminiscent of the program that was believed to have been called Echelon in the late 80s and early 90s, where some kind of NSA computer system is filtering essentially everything that's an overseas communication and using essentially sophisticated algorithms to siphon out communications that are suspect in some way because they include, for example, certain suspicious keywords or names of individuals that they want to be tracing. And that if you're only having this sort of after-the-fact approval of general guidelines, then you don't know, at least the court doesn't know, and the court isn't asked to make the distinction between guidelines that are used to filter communications that are all en masse passing through a system, and on the other hand, the more traditional kind of procedure where you have guidelines that tell you which particular persons you're going to target. You know, these are the guidelines we're using that will tell us we're going to tap this person's line, this person's emails.
Could I ask somebody to talk about the liability issues for communications companies and others that are dealt with or rather not dealt with in this legislation and why are those are important?
Well, I'm not a lawyer and I can't speak to the entirety of it, but I can talk about the AT&T case
sure.
and specifically what's going on with us.
Sure.
So Electronic Frontier Foundation, on behalf of all AT&T customers, has been suing the telecommunications provider for its illegal participation and collaboration with the government's massive spying program. As Julian was discussing, what is alleged in our lawsuit is a dragnet surveillance program, sucking up, doing this vacuum cleaner surveillance of millions of ordinary Americans' private communications, giving the NSA virtually unchecked backdoor access to the telecommunications network and call records databases. That's what we've alleged in our suit, and that suit is still going forward. In fact, we have a hearing next Wednesday before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on whether the case can move forward. The government has asserted its state secrets privilege to basically say that it's basically immune from any scrutiny in the court system. And we had an initial victory at the district court, and that's now on appeal. And that appeal is still going forward. You know, we're alleging dragnet surveillance. And the government hasn't said anything to the contrary about this bill permitting any sort of dragnet surveillance of the sort we've alleged.
And in fact, one of the things the president said in his statement on this bill was that it didn't solve the problem of, I forget exactly how he phrased it, but basically liability protection for companies that have assisted the nation in the wake of 9/11, which I think was a pretty clear reference to the fact that he thought that AT&T should get a free pass for any laws that they violated, but that they that this bill does not do that.
Right.
Well,
I mean, going back to last year, the president had been pushing for retroactive immunity, blanket immunity for all the telecommunication providers, and has indicated that he's going to come back for that when Congress returns from recess. That's be incredibly dangerous.
Well, let me play devil's advocate on this point, Derek and Tim, and basically push back a bit and say, why shouldn't there be certain types of liability exemptions for these carriers or some sort of protections? After all, they're doing things in some ways against their will. They don't necessarily want to be spying on their customers or anybody else, and yet their ass is on the line if they somehow overstep some boundaries which aren't always clearly drawn lines, right?
So, well, the fact of the matter is, though, Adam, that there are very clear boundaries in this regard when it comes to what authorization they need. And if the telecommunications providers got authorization that they need, then yes, potentially they could be immune as the statutes already permitted. But if they didn't, then they need to be held accountable for that. And holding those telecommunications providers accountable is one of the most critical checks we have against the government's invasions of privacy. Without some sort of accountability for those private entities, it's so much more difficult to keep the government in check. And the fact is that there already was, in existing statutes, protections for telecommunications companies operating with certain kinds of specific authorizations.
And in fact, I believe that the USA Today reported that Quest was approached by the NSA to participate in one of their programs. And Quest said, come back when you have a warrant. And as far as we know, the Bush administration didn't get the warrant, and they're not... the Quest customers are not having the data turned over to the NSA. I think it is, Derek's exactly right. If somebody tries to search my home, I can, stand at the front door and say, no, you can't come in unless I have a warrant. But if the government tries to eavesdrop on my phone conversations or my internet traffic, I'm not even going to know about it unless my phone company stands up for the rights that I could assert if I did know about it. But if the entire program is secret, my phone company is the only one in a position to defend my right to privacy. And so I think the phone company has a moral and a legal obligation to stand up for the rights of their customers in cases like this.
The law already offers sufficient protections for the providers on this score. And to go back and grant any broader immunity would create a really dangerous precedent, if you think about it, not just with regard to telecommunications providers, but beyond granting the sort of blanket immunity for the massive invasions of millions of ordinary Americans' privacy that's being alleged.
And this is another problem with the legislation that was just passed, is one of the provisions says that basically it gives not retroactive immunity, but going forward, it says that anybody who any telecommunications provider that complies with an order of the Director of National Intelligence is given immunity for anything they might have done. So even if a telecom provider would have the opportunity under the law to challenge surveillance, they have no reason to do so because they will not be held accountable under the law as is being done with this EFF case.
It's worth remembering that because the only role the FISA court plays here has to do with approving very general guidelines, that is to say the broad algorithms or minimization procedures that the NSA is using, that they're not looking at the particular facts of the case. That is, they're looking at the rules the NSA says they're following, the rules the NI says are in place. But they're not looking, as courts usually do, at actual fact patterns involving particular instances of surveillance, which means that the only place where the kind of as-applied scrutiny might be brought to bear here is at the point of the telecom company. And so if they have no incentive to be anything but maximally compliant, then at no point in the process is anyone really looking at how the program is actually being used as opposed to what abstract rules are supposedly being followed.
And guys, let me ask a question that's going to reveal my ignorance of this issue, but how broadly is telecommunications and telecommunications carrier defined in this case? Are we talking about everything from the old wireline copper network to the new fiber stuff to VoIP to wireless to internet-enabled everything? Is it everything in the kitchen sink, or is it just specific types of service and carriers?
My recollection is that the law does not say telecommunications provider at all. It just says person. Basically, if the Attorney General and the DNI come to somebody and says, we want you to do X, Y, and Z to help us surveil this person, that basically they have to follow the order and they're not liable if it's later challenged in court. So, yes, it applies to pretty much anybody who's providing any sort of telecommunication service.
And if the bad guy in question is texting over an IM service, that's covered if it's via AOL or what? I mean, it doesn't make a difference.
I assume that McConnell could go to AOL and say, we'd like you to, you know, give us a transcript of everything that this person has, or probably transcript of everybody that fits, you know, this description. And my reading of the bill would be that would be that they would be required to comply. There is a procedure they can challenge it, but the standards under which it's challenged are very permissive. And if they don't challenge it, that no, they would not be held liable for cooperating.
Right. And so, I mean, again, the question here is, given that there's no liability for compliance, what is their incentive to expend resources challenging? I mean, I guess public-spiritedness.
I'm interested in the politics of this, and maybe Derek or Julian can speculate. I mean, so the Democrats have vowed that they're going to come back in September and do it right this time. Do we have any expectation that they'll actually do that, and any idea about what the shape of the final legislation will look like?
Yeah, I mean, Feingold and a couple other people are saying that, you know, never mind waiting for this to expire in 6 months, which just as a tangent here, this bill was supposed to be a stopgap which sunsets in 6 months, but any orders issued to pursuant to it can run until they expire up to a year. So, you know, essentially that means if they wait until the end to authorize investigations or to reauthorize investigations, potentially, you know, we could see a year and a half from now is how long they have to continue doing this stuff without meaningful FISA court surveillance. But yeah, I mean, my worry here is that, again, the Bush administration has shown that they have an exceptional grasp of, I guess, what in chess you might call tempo. So they understand the value of kind of forcing these decisions in very short amounts of time at the last minute, and indeed of using this kind of preemptive veto threat in the same way they did in the case of funding for the Iraq War, where they say in advance, we will veto any bill with feature X, therefore if you don't pass what we want, it's not I'm vetoing the bill you pass, but you failing to pass the bill. Also, I think you know, the concern here is that once this is in place, they're not in the position of expanding surveillance power in some new way, which it's easier to get people excited about, but rather, aha, now they're trying to cut back on these vital and existing investigations that are already underway. And I think that'll be a lot more difficult in the election year for Democrats to get really sort of vigorous about.
I think that's exactly right. I think that now that the Democrats have conceded the point that the previous laws on the books were inadequate, it's going to be very hard for them to say, we don't actually need all these powers we just gave you, because if they were needed in the second half of 2007, why aren't they needed in 2008 or 2009? So I'm not optimistic, but I think some pressure from, especially from liberal Democrats, I think could be helpful, because we do have a primary coming up. It'd be very helpful to have presidential candidates, you know, making this a campaign issue and you know, at least a little bit of outrage from the people that nominally elected Democrats into power.
Right. One hopes that the Democratic leadership found instructive all of the op-eds across the country, all of the blogging across the country that, you know, describe the Democrats as bowing to the administration. Right? This was not a show of strength. This doesn't make them look strong. This isn't earning anyone's support. It's making them look weak in the eyes of many people who might otherwise support them. And that's unfortunate on its own terms. It's awful that they passed this legislation in the first place. And now you're right that there will be an uphill fight to get it off the books. But I think there is still some hope that can be done, again, with some of the leaders already talking about taking action in October before the sunset. As if people can really mobilize at this point, there's a chance that we can help get this off the books as soon as possible.
I'm also astonished that the Democratic leadership let this happen. I mean, some people have pointed out, well, look, you know, most Democrats voted against this. But the bottom line is that if the congressional leadership doesn't want something to move, it's not going to move, or at least it's a very long and cumbersome process to get legislation through Congress without the, you know, like over the objections of the leadership. So I do not understand. I guess they were just terrified of this soft on terrorism label, but I do not understand politically what they thought they would gain from passing it when they did, because, you know, the election's more than a year away. It's not like they're going to, you know, it's not like voters are going to remember that, oh, they passed this legislation in August instead of September. And so I don't understand how the politics there work.
I want to throw in, actually, on the political front, an interesting point that I think was actually a blogger at Daily Coast spotted this, that on the vote on the Senate bill, there were 6 Democratic senators and 6 Republican senators, 12 total, not voting on this incredibly contested bill, which is very unusual. I mean, I think the last time 6 senators of either party were not voting on something, it was when it was essentially a bill that was guaranteed to pass, a bill where the outcome was clear. Which does suggest that sort of both parties were essentially so what you have to remember here is that what it means is that 6 Republicans also were not voting, which means the Republicans seem to have believed that they were safe enough to allow 6 of their representatives to not show up, which means they must have known in advance what the outcome was going to be, which at least the blogger was suggesting indicates some kind of deal being made there. So this was not just a question of individual Democrats deciding they like this bill, but some kind of explicit arrangement. But that's hard. I mean, we just need someone to follow up on that and figure out what was going on behind the scenes.
Is it possible, though, that those 6 Republicans were just I mean, it's hard to believe, I guess, on a quote-unquote terrorism issue like this, but that those 6 Republicans were just in liberal states and were afraid of some sort of voter backlash?
Well, but the question remains, right? So maybe they were allowed not to vote for that reason. It doesn't seem that likely to me either. But even then, the question is whether the leadership would permit that unless it was clear to them what the outcome were going to be. I mean, I think if there were any question about whether or not this bill was going to pass the Senate, mm-hmm. You know, there would not be a willingness in the Republican leadership to accommodate the desire of those senators not to vote.
Sure, sure.
Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Julian Sanchez, Derek Slater, and Tim Lee for joining us this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something we said here on today's show, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this specific show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Pearce. See you then.